Hello, and welcome to My Inevitable Murder. I'm your host, Anne Elizabeth Moore, and the victim of the heinous crime we've been investigating for over a year now. And today, we're going to catch my murderer. Or are we? This is Season 1, Episode 7, The Killer, the final episode of an investigative true crime podcast about the murder of a local investigative true crime podcaster based in beautiful Delaware County, New York. If this is your first time joining us, I would urge you to put your headset down right now and go download the initial 6 episodes. Try listening to those first. Doesn't have to be in order, I'm not the boss of you. But this episode is unlikely to make much sense unless you've heard how the whole case is unfolded. Because this is a true crime podcast, unlike other true crime podcasts. Yes, okay, there's spooky music and often crappy audio, and sometimes our investigator, me, fails to ask the right questions or reach the conclusions that are so obvious to everyone else. Just like every other true crime podcast you've ever listened to. But there's no dead woman's body to avenge here. So if you're expecting some creepy white cis male with frowned upon sexual tendencies to show up in this episode with a bloody knife, then get handcuffed and hauled off to jail by police, you're not going to find it. There is nothing that looks like justice at the end of this episode. A death of sorts did, however, occur. I don't know how to describe what died or the precise manner of its killing, but the absence is palpable, and I firmly believe that future such losses may be preventable. We just need to be willing to prevent them. You like hot sauce? I mean, who doesn't? I guess some people don't, but statistics show that most people who like true crime podcasts also like hot sauce, so I'm pretty sure you do. Not very hot sauce, because we don't need to get all competitive about it. Just spicy enough to remind you that you're alive, although a little bit too spicy to use as an eyewash. That's the kind of hot sauce we specialize in at Tinkertown Provisions. We use a unique blend of chili peppers and other natural ingredients in a secret process to handcraft hot sauce that is allergen-free and surprisingly high in potassium. So skip that daily banana and head on over to our Instagram page, at Tinkertown Provisions, to place your wholesale order now or to receive updates on our Western Catskills storefront. I have a new book out. It's called Body Horror, Capitalism, Fear, Misogyny, Jokes, and it's available now from Feminist Press. Daniel Krauss, who co-wrote The Living Dead with George A. Romero, said, quote, "I laughed, I cried, I puked, I cheered." Isn't that the sweetest? As you can imagine, Body Horror is both hilarious and disgusting. Hilarigusting. And it's available now wherever books are sold, and in several places where books are not normally sold, like if you go over to your aunt's house who you suspect might secretly be a witch, she probably has a copy on her dining room table or in her bathroom. And if you steal it, she won't tell your parents, and secretly be proud at what a fine young person you have turned out to be. It's also available as an audiobook from Orange Sky Audio on Spotify. That's Body Horror, Capitalism, Fear, Misogyny, Jokes by Anne Elizabeth Moore. Pick it up today!
My name is Harlow, and I am the Director of Digital Security at Freedom of the Press Foundation. We're a small team. We do a number of public-facing trainings, more private and bespoke security consulting, and general advising for media makers, primarily those who work in, you know, the more traditional journalism field. But we also work with documentary filmmakers and people who work in things that are a little bit more mobile first, podcasters and the like. There's a number of ways that digital security affects how journalism gets done nowadays. And that could be, you know, giving people the ability to face threats against their newsroom and the work that they do. If someone tries to, let's say, break into your email because you're being hacked and look at documents that people or you as a journalist didn't want to publish because it was part of your source material that you were working with, that's one example of why digital security becomes all the more important, because people are now being encouraged to secure access to their accounts. And that's just one example. Ultimately, a lot of journalists find themselves not necessarily as supported as they should be beyond the individual. If, let's say, someone comes for them on social media in retaliation for what they publish. And so giving journalists the tools that they need to protect those accounts, and also giving the organizations that they're writing for the ability to understand what these threats are and to offer support wherever they possibly can, has been another project that we've contributed to across the industry.
I've been following the work of FPF over the years. The group was central to the Edward Snowden, Julian Assange, and Chelsea Manning cases, which I watched closely not only as a journalist, but as someone who'd received threats for my own work from much tinier forces than the whole of the U.S. government. So Harlow seemed like a great person to talk to me about journalists' digital security.
We learned so much about, let's say, the NSA's ability to intercept email underneath their PRISM program. But then, while that had been incredibly interesting from a privacy perspective across the globe, we also understood that, well, if you're relying upon a tool such as email that is intercepted and could be, you know, highly surveilled in certain circumstances, what does that mean for someone who has an email correspondence with someone in a very sensitive position as a whistleblower? How can we outfit a journalist with the tools that they're going to need in order to maintain that confidentiality that a source definitely deserves? And so that led to building tools such as SecureDrop in order to enable journalists technologically to have these types of conversations that need to be kept as sensitive and confidential as possible. I mean, a tool like SecureDrop is not always going to be applicable to every single journalist's, you know, realities. And so, in which case, we have to look to the really excellent work developed within, like, the internet freedom space, the circumvention technology space, and the privacy space to find applicable ways to take mature tools and put them into people's hands to operationalize them. That's one of the reasons why, like, tools like Signal and WhatsApp are so ubiquitous now. It's because people within this kind of sphere saw ways that those tools could be popularized and also made accessible enough to get sources into the conversation and give journalists a really cleared roadmap on how they could use them in their day-to-day practice.
Lately, though, I've noticed a slackening of personal safety concerns. In fact, just before I got on the call with Harlow, someone had asked me to email them my social security number. I tell Harlow that I thought we'd all become accustomed to educating ourselves and protecting ourselves online in, say, 2015 and 2016, but that I'd recently found that I not only had to do a lot of that educating myself, but that I also had to apologize for sounding like a paranoid weirdo for wanting to use something like SecureDrop or Signal for exchanging certain kinds of information online.
I definitely do hear you about there being a waning memory of why these things were so important and why, like, you know, almost a decade ago, people were so excited to tackle these issues of privacy and find solutions and also do the work to get lawyers, for instance, or, like, you know, notaries or any of these, like, services that we deal with to take privacy seriously and to create solutions that help us get better at maintaining people's privacy. I mean, I wouldn't call it complacency, but I do think that we've yet to get to a point where we're reinvigorated about it. But there are simple things that thankfully we do have access. You know, for instance, if you do have the ability to receive this information via WhatsApp, then you can just use that bit of information from there that I want to keep confidential. And, you know, we can continue as normal after that. There are certain types of conversations that definitely should take place on a platform like Signal because they're way too sensitive. You want to minimize any harm that you could do, especially when you're having like introductory conversations to someone whose situation you don't know yet and could be in way more danger than you perceive coming down the line. But then there's also certain conversations that it is acceptable to have over email, especially if there are any concerns about liability towards the organization that you're writing for. So if something does require a paper trail, perhaps you do have to not shy away from email as long as you have the full knowledge that these are the types of conversations that you can have there, and they can only be perceived as confidential as possible given the limitations of those platforms. You know, use a reputable password manager to make sure that you have unique passphrases for absolutely everything. Also, use two-factor authentication. Yeah, make sure that you're especially if you are a public-facing individual, make sure that you're aware of where all of your social media might give members of the public way more information about your personal life than they should be privy to. The internet is not a safe space for people's information, and it has not been for several years. And yet we do want to once again resist this general feeling that that's acceptable, that we don't have a right to having a private life. Journalists are especially vulnerable to interactions with people who might want to do them harm.
I asked Harlow if all journalists across the board are targeted, or if more marginalized folks genuinely did get it worse than other journalists did.
It's definitely journalists across the board. However, that type of virulent behavior is definitely waged more, especially against women and journalists of color and journalists within the LGBTQ community. This is just a statistic out there. And while journalists across the board, every single person who, you know, works within this industry faces the same threats to their well-being and their security and their confidence to do this job, one thing that is incredibly important to note is that a lot of the tactics that can be used against absolutely every single journalist, those tactics were honed by enemies to this profession against, once again, women, people of color, and people belonging to the LGBTQ community. When women are speaking about these particular threats, they're coming at it not only from their positions as individuals on this planet, but also with a vast breadth of professional experience where they have seen where this is going if we don't stop it from happening.
I had called Harlow to pick her brain about the specific kind of threats that I'd received as a journalist, but at the same time, I'd asked my friend Megan to go in and clean up the after effects of those same threats. You'll remember from the last episode when Nancy mentioned an article I wrote that, about 24 hours after publication, started to get a very unusual and specific kind of feedback. All from followerless Twitter bots, accounts with no pictures, and generic or no names, most of them only a day or so old. The messages all said the same thing. Kill yourself. Sure, some said, kill yourself, bitch, others said, kill yourself now, and still others said, fucking kill yourself. But the gist was pretty consistent. At first, the messages were coming in a few at a time, and because I have experienced online harassment before, I knew exactly what to do. Block and report, repeat, repeat, repeat. But this didn't seem to be doing anything, and more kill yourself messages were coming in all the time. So after a few hours of blocking and reporting, and then a few hours sitting next to the Delaware River, I set my account to private, which also did nothing. When they started, maybe 10 messages had been coming in per hour. I could go through Twitter's whole blocking and reporting rigmarole with just enough time to take a breath before the next message came in to block and report. But by the next morning, 48 hours after the piece had been published, or 24 hours since the harassment had begun, and maybe 12 or so hours since I had set my account to private, I could barely log in at all. And by the time I did, the screen was filled with new messages from new users. Even though a private account should mean I only got messages from accounts I already followed. I estimate that I got nearly 100 new messages each time I sat at my computer that day, and I probably logged in 10 different times. That's about 1,000 messages per day, all somehow breaking through the most strident privacy settings Twitter had. As far as I could tell, that kept up for about 6 weeks, although I stopped logging in every day because on day 3, I started getting emails, really unhinged messages from people that did in fact appear to be real, who had not read my original article, but had read the threats against me. These messages also sought to explain to me that I should kill myself. Then on day 4, I got a phone call at my unlisted number. This caller no longer thought I should kill myself. He wanted to do it for me and appeared to know how to find me to do so. So I left town. My gun-collecting neighbor was delighted to watch my house for me, holding the rifle he placed next to his door for the occasion. When I returned home a few weeks later, my Twitter account was still a wall of anonymous suicide demands. They only slowed a couple weeks after that. I waited about a year before asking Megan to go in and document what I assumed would be a shitstorm of hate.
Testing, testing. This is Megan Finch reporting for duty on Anne Elizabeth Moore's Twitter that has been firebombed. We're gonna go in, we're gonna see how it's going in there, in the melee. I've got sparkling water, but I also have wine if I need to upgrade. And yeah, it took us a minute to get me in there. Two-factor authentication was surprisingly difficult to hack.
Megan Finch is the genius behind Murder She Won't Shut Up About, everyone's favorite anti-cop, pro-Angela Lansbury, cozy mystery recap podcast. She's also a really great visual artist, now living on the West Coast, and we've known each other since she was an art school student. I asked Megan to hack into my Twitter account out of a strange and potentially misplaced desire for some good old-fashioned intergenerational feminist consciousness raising. When I was an emerging artist, folks did a lot of telling me I could be president someday, but never bothered describing the structures that might keep me from becoming president so that I could figure out how to dismantle them. I will also mention that I paid her to do this. No one should have to face that shit at all. I only did it for as long as I could, because maintaining a social media presence is literally part of my job, but certainly no one should have to do it for free. So I paid Megan to clean up my Twitter account, because one, she's a superstar, and two, she knows how to work a mic. But three, also because even though everything about this task sucks, I think it's important that women remain keenly aware of the kind of treatment they may be subjected to if, as Nancy said in our last episode, people decide that you're the problem.
And when I opened it up, let's see, we have only 7 messages, which isn't that many. It says 20 plus notifications, and it says welcome back. So let's start with the messages. So it looks like all the already read messages are straight up normal people talking, no attacks. So October 23rd, someone named Doug said, just reading the attacks on you, what an insane medium. You're right, Doug. You're so right. Susan is, hi, Anne, I just read your extraordinary story. Yes, it was extraordinary. Heartbreaking and infuriating. Okay, so now we're gonna go to the notifications. A couple recent suspicious login attempts, that would have been me. So far, people are liking tweets that Anne was mentioned in. Everything's very pleasant. Yeah, everyone's saying, oh, this book sounds fabulous. Oh, this is stuff about body horror. So this is all pretty recent. People are retweeting stuff about what we're reading, Gentrifier, great. So this is weird because it is generally pleasant. Okay, here's somebody saying, I don't think @SuperAnne is on here much these days, but I want to hear her response to this American Girl zine kit. That does look interesting. I too want to hear Anne's response to that. All right, we're scrolling. We're in January now of the notifications. It's like this has been cleaned with bleach.
I can't tell you what I expected from this process, but I can tell you that it was not a reasonably clean social media account. I guess I had thought that since blocking and reporting and setting my account to private had failed back in October of 2022, that all the shittiness would still be there for Megan to find and document a year later. But that did not seem to be the case.
Okay, here's some stuff from December. Another thing about American Girl dolls, Anne got tagged in. I didn't know that was one of your specialties, Anne.
Okay, a brief aside about American Girl dolls. I did a shop dropping project at American Girl Place in downtown Chicago 20 years ago, placing little leaflets that looked like American Girl product inside the store that questioned what was really being sold there. Girls picked them up, asked their moms about them, conversation ensued. It was actually pretty heartwarming. And, I'll add, not a violation of any known laws. But Mattel, the owners of American Girl Place, didn't like it much. The second time I did it, they called a whole team of cops, 10 to 12 of them, all decked out in bulletproof vests. Some even had riot gear helmets, which was hilarious. To detain me, and then perp walk me out of the store in front of all the cute little shoppers and their guardians. After we got out on the sidewalk, one of the officers told me I was banned from American Girl Place for life, and then said, and I quote, "Freedom of speech is not allowed in American Girl Place." An op-ed I wrote drawing connections between the explicitly consumerist environment and censorship was in the news cycle for a bit, and about 2 years later, I met someone who worked at Mattel who said my picture was still up on a security billboard at that same American Girl Place. But the biggest impact of the project was that folks have continued to ask me, for 20 years, what I thought about all the ways Mattel tries to encroach upon, shape, and commodify American girlhood, and therefore American feminism. In case you're thinking of writing in with such a question, I'll just tell you now. I'm against them.
Here we go. All right. In the mentions, it's where everything is. We're now in October 2022, which is when the story came out that triggered all of this. And these are a little messy. It seems like the first one that I see, it seems like they are having a conversation on a thread by somebody who liked the article with somebody who's limited viewership their tweets, right? So I can't read the tweets to which this person is responding. This person is called Estrogen Appraiser, and really the majority of what they're saying is, listen, man, I'd love to have a good faith conversation about this, but if you're going to misrepresent facts and fill in the blanks, instead of accepting that the article is written poorly, I don't know how to talk to you. The article is written perfectly fine.
Hold on. Gotta let the cat in.
Cat is in. Back to it. Oh, this someone says she makes me ill, hiding behind a private account. I haven't seen any death threats yet, and I wonder if those got wiped. All right, here's what could be construed as a genuine threat, which is somebody said, "You can't hide forever," at Super Ann, crying laughing emoji. Someone else says, at Super Ann, you are not a good person. So I told Ann as we were preparing for me to do this, I was like, oh, it's going to be fine. I'm not going to be traumatized by this. I'm used to people being awful on the internet. But it is upsetting me because these aren't cartoonishly awful people. They're just not having, like, a normal moral take. Somebody whose at is the realist 007 says this white lady is definitely not seeing heaven. Someone said bottom of the barrel scum at Super Ann. A lot of people are mad that Ann made her account private. Ooh, here we go. Here's some real mean shit. Ann, you are the literal definition of a snowflake. You thought writing this drivel. This person is called You Need Therapy, by the way. You thought writing this drivel would earn you praise, and now you had to shut down your social. I hope Anne sees this, and I hope her shame, guilt, and self-righteous spelling in context gives her insomnia for life. Yeah, a lot of people just didn't read the article. This person is called The Breastification of America, and they have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 trash can emojis, and 1, 2. Something over 25 shit emojis. Very good. People want Anne to get a real job. And you hear that little beep, that's me screenshotting. She is a villain along with
beep beep.
Hear that, Anne? You're a villain. Mwahaha. Someone says she kind of sucks. I'm not seeing the death threats. I really wonder if Twitter cleaned it up. Okay, so now we are at... I'm scrolling through the mentions, and we have gotten to October 19th, 2022, and we're back to normal. We're back to normal. Like, the storm is over, all the mean mentions are gone, people are responding to the story with normal responses of, wow, this is a chilling tale, wow, this is really, I'm not surprised, like, I'd like to hear more about this, good reporting on a really messed up situation. And then, you know, birthday parties for cats, which I'm assuming is kind of a normal and notification, you know, city corruption, birthday parties for cats. This is all looking normal. This is definitely not 1,000 notifications worth of stuff. This is really interesting. I'm gonna scroll back to October 20th-ish. Nobody, absolutely nothing in the messages. I think Twitter must have had something to do with this, Anne, but I didn't see any actual threats, and I really do think that this account has been cleaned, deep cleaned, which is some conspiracy stuff, but that's what we got. All right, I love you, Anne. I'm sorry you went through this. Investigative journalist Megan Finch signing off.
The part of all of this, maybe the only part, that I really couldn't deal with was going back in and documenting the threats. Although that is exactly what you are supposed to do in this situation, in case the threats escalate or start up again. As we've seen over and over in this season of the podcast, evidence matters in murder investigations. But here is Megan telling me that the evidence was gone. What appears to have happened is that the bot messages, the ones that seemed automated in the first place, increased in frequency over time and snuck through all of Twitter's security measures, those had disappeared, leaving real people engaging in genuine, if occasionally mean-spirited, debate. Well, not all the evidence was gone. There are people I spoke to at the time, Nancy, Jared, my editors, who either watched it go down from their own computer screens or watched me react to it in real time. But the messages themselves had evaporated. There are rational explanations. Almost a year had gone by since I'd blocked and reported all those messages, a year during which the billionaire
beep
took over the platform and then got publicly lambasted for letting security measures slide so severely. Maybe Twitter just went back in and finally did something about the many, many reports I'd filed, erased textbook harassment messages by the thousands, and eliminated accounts clearly created exclusively for this campaign. Maybe it's corporate responsibility, but it also feels like gaslighting. A whole mass of threatening messages that had upended my life and career had vanished, too late, from the internet. Little evidence of them could be found by an independent researcher. And for a moment, even though being told to kill myself by thousands of social media accounts was bad, the suggestion that it might never have happened at all was worse. I didn't really need to explain to Harlow why it was bad, of course, because her entire job is to try to keep this stuff from happening to genernimalists before it starts.
There is two things that are at play before we even get to, you know, the content that anyone publishes or the way that it makes a readership feel. One, we are technically enabled to show one another abuse that is unheard of ever before. And this is the fault of the platforms. This is also the fault of an industry that is aggressively dealing in our data that, once again, makes it all the more easy to access data that normally a horrible person, you know, who's having like, who has a little bit of time on their hands and are having a very bad day shouldn't have access to. Another has to do with a somewhat waning respect for the press as they show up in the public sphere, which is dictated by these platforms. This has happened before, but it's not normal that members of the press, by educating the public is held with as much contempt as we've seen in, you know, recent years. And that contempt is being stoked by, you know, a cultural milieu with very, very dangerous rhetoric towards this profession. I think it's the combination of those two things that make it seem like it is perfectly normal, perfectly okay, and perfectly to be expected as being a journalist to face that type of abuse. The public at large, even the platforms themselves, politicians across the globe, people who could enact policy should they want to advocate for greater protections, they have not at all taken the responsibility to look at what this means from a cultural moment's perspective and right a wrong.
Hold on to that thought for a second. The government holds a responsibility to protect the public. We'll come back to it. In this moment, what I said to Harlow was that, considering the volume and intensity of the threats I was receiving, I was crushed to get only a standard form letter from the publishing outlet that more or less said, quote, try to stay away from the computer for a couple days. Actually, though, it was worse than that, because this story ran in two publications. The second one told me straight up that they did not believe the harassment was happening. By the time I received the note from the other publication, I had already left town while my armed neighbor watched my house. I remember realizing how ludicrous both of these responses were and thinking, this is not the world I want to live in.
I think that that phrase is entirely key. This is not the world that I want to live in. One of the things that I actually at this point love to spotlight a lot of work done by members of the Coalition Against Online Violence, of which there are a couple of organizations, FPF is part of it, but the vast majority of the mobilization efforts on this stuff comes from amazing groups like PEN America and the International Women's Media Foundation and a couple of other excellent organizations.
From the Online Violence Response Hub, the website of the Coalition Against Online Violence, quote, 73% of women journalists have experienced online violence. One third of women journalists consider leaving the profession due to online attacks and threats, and 20% of women journalists have been attacked or abused offline in connection with online abuse, end quote. That's one in five.
I think another thing that you mentioned is interesting is that you received guidance from an organization that was, you know, there to support you, saying that maybe you just want to like step away from the computer until this subsides. There should always be a number of options on the table as to how to respond. No one should say without any other option, step away from the computer. I mean, of course, if you are the type of person who feels most safe forgetting that the internet was ever invented, that's fine. But if that's not the tack that you want to take, because that is a space that is so key and core to the work that you do, and you don't want abusers to know that that's how they made you respond, then by all means, stay on the computer and also expect that organization to be just as willing to help you if you decide to stay on your computer.
You'll notice that Harlow and I don't ever circle back to talk about the content of my piece. To be honest, I'm not sure how relevant it really is to this discussion. Maybe someday I'll dig into all that again, but for now you need to know that there was a pretty clear bad guy in my reporting. Even though Estrogen Appraiser, Realist 007, and Breastification of America seem to miss it in favor of harassing a woman online. That bad guy was a municipal entity. The same government Harlow was just suggesting might consider passing laws to protect journalists. And since none of these accounts ever called any aspect of my reporting into question, they just called my writing bad, or me bad, or jumped straight to demanding my suicide, most of the backlash didn't make a ton of sense. How could my death possibly correct an injustice that a government body had committed? It couldn't. It would only silence me. Then there were the similarities between so many threats, each supposedly coming from a separate individual user. I began at some point to get the sense that this was an organized campaign, all emanating from a single source. But there is really only one entity that would benefit from such a campaign, the bad guy I'd written about, who would benefit from silencing me. It's not quite as bananas as it seems. It's not unheard of for an entity to create what we used to call sock puppet accounts to try to silence critical voices. In fact, HBO was doing it in 2020 and 2021 to try to get TV critics to stop complaining about plot points in their shows. According to Rolling Stone, CEO Casey Bloys and another HBO exec planned to use a, quote, secret army to harass and demean critics on Twitter and to seed positive comments about the shows on the websites of trade publications. Documents attesting to so-called secret operatives and untraceable accounts verify the use of such tactics on a fairly consistent basis. In my case, the municipal entity that stood to benefit from my silencing was also in charge of managing FOIA requests. So when I submitted a request for documents relating specifically to me and to my article, I received a response I found alarming. Quote, "Your request is granted in part and denied in part," the letter reads. "We expect that once these documents are retrieved and reviewed, portions thereof will be exempt. However, we will not know the nature and extent of the exemptions until the review takes place. Your request is also denied to the extent that the records are of a confidential or personal nature under beep." In short, I could look at the documents that the Freedom of Information Act guarantees I have access to, but only some of them, and only after they had been sufficiently redacted to protect whoever they believe might be harmed by the revelation of the confidential or personal details contained therein, clearly not me. And those redactions would incur costs, because they were likely to be extensive, and would take at least 164 hours, or approximately 20 and a half working days. For this, I would be charged a little under $600.
That's your retro tactic.
To be clear, I could pay the fee and receive thousands of pages of documents redacted to protect someone who is clearly not me. I think what I was surprised by was that there would have been so much conversation generated in the first place on FOIA-able government servers.
The FOIA episode is very interesting, and it's not the first time that especially a government agency might dangle a fee for processing, even though FOIAing is free, but it's not unheard of that in order to prevent the journalist from actually receiving those documentations, they'll dangle a fee. In terms of the coordination of a campaign, it would be very interesting to see that the information gained from a FOIA could give you a smoking gun as to whether or not within the United States, a government agency representative of, like, you know, our democratic process were actually coordinating such types of campaigns explicitly, especially within anything that is FOIA-able and is only gatekept by $600.
What Harlow is saying is that most government agencies wouldn't plan coordinated attacks from FOIA-able computers. And if they did, they would be unlikely to do so and charge only $600 to disclose the info. I think that puts a lot of trust in government agencies that, in this case, have already doubled down on doing harm to constituents. Again, my original reporting was never called into question. But I do concede that there is unlikely to be a smoking gun made available to me for only $600, or I would have paid the $600 to retrieve it. But, Harlow notes,
coordinated campaigns like that do exist, and this is the scary thing about the culture of online harassment, is that it doesn't necessarily take orders on high from within the halls of power to have such a coordinated campaign spring up amongst people who are just horrible, but are really, really enthusiastic about creating those campaigns. The KYS attack, as some people like to call it, who do research on this particular subject, is not very imaginative. It's hurtful and incredibly shocking that someone would do it, but it's not imaginative. 1,000 monkeys at 1,000 typewriters can come up with, you know, 1,000 variations of a really, really harmful KYS message without much coordination, but the coordination would be in just pushing people towards a particular target, in which case that was what you had written.
At this point, it would probably be helpful to know a little bit more about your victim. I am a person with multiple physical ailments, most of which involve chronic pain, and not a one of them curable. Effective treatments are in short supply, and to make the situation even more confusing, I keep accruing new diseases that no one can explain. All these diseases are autoimmune in nature. And one of the things we don't understand about autoimmune diseases, since we don't really understand the immune system, is how they start. If we don't know how they start, we don't know how to stop them. So people with these diseases often live their lives in increasing amounts of pain with no hope for medical relief, especially people like me who acquire new autoimmune diseases at the drop of a hat because so many of the supposedly effective treatments for autoimmune disease also, unfortunately, cause new autoimmune diseases. To sugarcoat it for you, I'll label this a depressing situation. Folks like me are left with few to no viable medical options. This will be the goriest thing I say on this podcast about murdering and violence against women and threats to my own life, but the number one cause of death for folks with many of these diseases is suicide. That's how painful and hopeless they can be. I have a couple friends who don't listen to this podcast because they don't want to energetically support the manifestation of my violent death. That's totally fair, and I love them for it. But what most people might never consider, maybe especially able-bodied people who aren't watching disease slowly and irreversibly overtake their own bodies, is that imagining a violent death at the hands of a single identifiable killer is actually kind of soothing if the alternative seems to be ending your own life after decades of medical disinterest and systematically perpetrated neglect. Murder is something people get mad about, and true crime podcasters like me log hours of recordings to document and investigate and resolve. Violent death gets written about and talked about and remembered, and either someone is brought to justice, or it is considered a horrible injustice if no one ever is. But disease is not like that, or at least not autoimmune disease. Some get walks and funds and ribbons. But even then, when you die with disease, you contribute to a statistic. Your death's sad, but inevitable. I have another friend who does listen to this podcast and called me brave once for making it. I don't think there's a single moment in the several hours of yammering I've put you through so far where that's felt earned until this one. And mustering the courage to type it took all my energy, several months, and a whole lot of tears. I don't want to be forced to take my own life. And the extremely frustrating possibility that I will makes the demand that I do it shockingly cruel.
I'd follow up finally with revisiting that bit of advice that you got, which I'm gathering wasn't very helpful to you, which is step away from the computer. It seems like really like a blithe kind of dismissal of how you felt and also providing like a tactic that literally is not going to help you. But there are certain middle grounds within certain platforms. I don't know exactly what platform it, or where you encountered like the most of that abuse, but it is perfectly okay to filter out comments like those based off of certain keywords. And thankfully, because a campaign like a KYS is not very imaginative, it makes it very, very easy to filter those out. So you're not seeing that on social media platforms. I suspect you have a lot more courage than the vast majority of people because you're like, I don't want to step away from my computer. But part of what makes those campaigns so psychologically damaging is that the sheer volume of it is a source of embarrassment and shame to some people. Now, the caveat, though, is literally within a couple of months, all of the work that organizations have been doing with social media platforms, especially Twitter, have basically been undone by horrible decisions regarding trust and safety within those platforms. Twitter, we always point to as the big culprit here, which is fair because of the amount of traffic, especially within the journalism industry that Twitter accounts for. But Twitter's not the only group. It's just the only one to do it so dramatically. There have been a lot of rolling back of like trust and safety measures and the addition of various tools in order to manage online harassment. And so right now we're at a little bit of an unsure place. But that said, those tools still exist, and we just have to hope that the culture within social media as we use it makes people more enthusiastic about making those places safer in the future.
As you heard, and as Megan shared evidence of, I had made use of those tools. I had also reached out to the systems of support available to me, and none of it helped. That, I think, did end up silencing me. I started turning down writing gigs if platforms didn't have robust security measures, made a lot of hot sauce, deleted my long-beloved Twitter account. Goodbye to all that harassment, ran the headline on Sarah Jong's farewell to the platform. Promoting books became almost impossible. If none of the meager systems put in place to protect me were going to function when I needed them to, how was I supposed to get the work done? It wasn't, I repeat, the threats that caused the most damage. It was the total lack of support in responding to them that I couldn't abide.
We are so alarmed by how quickly a platform like Twitter went from showing such a like invested charge towards making that platform safer, not only through like the hiring decisions that they have, but also the tools that they started to incorporate, to getting themselves in positions where they lost not only everyone who has like a theoretical handle on the problem space, but also with the ability to actually make the code work to the point where these things become ineffective. It's one of those never ascribe to malice what can easily be pinned on ignorance, you know, kind of a thing. But like, who knows what the proportions of each are? Not only Twitter, but any of those platforms can reverse their course at any point due to a cascade of failures. And it leaves journalists without an actual home for their work that is as effective as those platforms. And there are alternatives out there, but they don't have the same momentum. They don't have the same resources. They don't have the same reach. And perhaps there is a diminished sense of wanting to belong to the public sphere in that way.
After about an hour, I thought I'd better let Harlow get back to her extremely important work of stopping this from happening to other people. So I asked if maybe she had something uplifting to say. Then we both laughed.
You are also working within a medium that I have a lot of hope and enthusiasm for. The discourse coming from like an audio first medium is different than what you might see in other platforms. The platforms where people reach this information makes a humongous, humongous difference. The platforms where these things are presented facilitate different types of interactions with the public at large that are incredibly nuanced, such as Patreon does not enable like trolls to come destroy your entire messaging. Whereas on Twitter, one thing that Twitter was fighting was that there would be more emphasis with certain types of users to pile onto abusive interactions rather than actually consuming the media that they're supposed to get so angry about.
About this, indeed, about all things we discussed, Harlow is right. Podcasting does feel like a safe way to write and publish, even on the most vulnerable of topics, like my own murder. And maybe this is the upside to the popularity of the true crime podcast, even as it contributes to the public imaginary of piles of dead women's bodies. Perhaps the ubiquity of the genre indicates a widespread desire to experience the world in the safest possible manner. What if this popularity could be used to right the wrongs Harlow mentioned? The wrongs I suspect our government may be fine with ignoring. What if it was the audience of true crime podcasts who ended up making the world a safer and better place for journalists and true crime podcasters? Wouldn't that start to feel like justice? This has been The Killer, the final episode in the first season of My Inevitable Murder, the true crime investigative podcast in which, for the last year, we've been asking ourselves, what is true? What is crime? And what constitutes an investigation? I've really enjoyed working with you all on this case, and while I'm not sure we can consider it closed exactly, it no longer feels unsolved. I'm also happy to report that I somehow ended this season completely unmurdered, but you'll have to tune in next season to find out how long that lasts. This podcast has been a project of Tinkertown Provisions LLC, a hot sauce and media content creation enterprise based in upstate New York. My Inevitable Murder is made possible by the New York State Council on the Arts with the support of the Office of the Governor and the New York State Legislature. Special thanks to Harlow Holmes and Freedom of the Press Foundation for all the work that they do to protect Geronimalists and democracy, including talking to me for this podcast. And deep gratitude to Megan Finch for general awesomeness and an unusual volume of intrepidness. Thanks are also due, by the way, to my fact-checker Meredith Clark, who's probably the reason that my original reporting still stands up, even if I refuse to. Our next season will be called The Poisoning, and we've already started working on it. It won't be available for public download for several months, so to hear each episode as it is completed, you're going to have to hop on over to our show page at patreon.com/myinevitablemurder and subscribe for any amount. A dollar. $1 million. Every single dollar in the world. Or anything in between. We'll upload episodes there on an approximately monthly basis, and then release them to the public in a massive binge-friendly dump. Please note that credit card statements may list your transaction as hot sauce. In the meantime, please make sure to subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app, share this episode with friends, and go ahead and give us a 5-star rating. Why not? You only live once. Okay, say goodbye to the people.